"We have," Jay said. "Hello there, Blackthorns." Livy sighed. She was looking at Jace the way Emma had when she was 12. Drew, loyal to her crush on Diego, just glared. "Why are you here?" Julian asked, though he knew the answer. Still, it was better to build up the idea that you were surprised. People trusted your answers more when they thought they weren't rehearsed.
"Dark magic," said Magnus. "A huge flare of it on the map, at the convergence site."
He split his gaze toward Emma.
"I thought you might do something with that bit of information I gave you. Where ley lines are concerned, the convergence is always key."
"Why didn't you go there, then?" Emma asked. "To the convergence?"
"Magnus checked it out with a spell," Clary said. "There was nothing there but some wreckage, so we portaled here."
"From my sister's engagement party, to be precise," said Jace. "There was an open bar."
"Oh," a look of happiness flitted across Emma's face. "Isabel's marrying Simon?" As far as Julian was concerned, no girl had ever been born who could compare to Emma, but when Clary smiled, she was very pretty. Her whole face lit up. It was something she and Emma had in common, actually.
"Yeah," Clary said, "he's really happy."
"Mazel tov to them," said Jace, leaning against the banister rail. "Anyway, we were at the party, and Magnus got this alert about necromantic magic near the L.A. Institute, and he tried to reach Malcolm, but no luck. So we snuck out, just the four of us. Which is a big loss to the party, if you ask me, because I was going to give a toast. And it was going to be glorious. Simon would never be able to show his face in public again."
"Not really the point of an engagement toast, Jace," Clary said. She was looking worriedly at Diego. He was awfully pale.
"Four of you," Emma looked around the room. "Is Alec here?" Magnus opened his mouth to answer, but at that moment the doors of the sanctuary burst open, and a tall, stocky man with dark hair emerged. Robert Lightwood, the current Inquisitor, second in command to the Consul of Idris, and in charge of investigating shadow hunters who had broken the law. Julian had met the Inquisitor exactly once before, when he'd been forced to stand up in front of the Council and give his account of Sebastian's attack on the Institute. He remembered holding the mortal sword in his hand, the feeling of the truth being dragged out of you with knives and hooks, of your internal organs tearing apart. He had never lied when he was asked about the attack, had never wanted or planned to. But it hurt just the same. And bearing the mortal sword, even for such a short time, had forged an indelible bond in his mind between truth and pain. The Inquisitor strode toward him. He was a little older than the Robert Lightwood Julian remembered, his hair more liberally streaked with gray. But the look in his dark blue eyes was the same, hard and cold.
"What's going on here?" he demanded. "There was a flare of necromantic magic traced to this institute several hours ago, and your uncle claims to know nothing about it. More troubling, he refused to tell us where you disappear to."
He spun around, his eyes raking their group, and landing on Mark.
"Mark Blackthorn?"
"I already said that," said Clary.
Julian had the feeling she wasn't overly fond of her prospective father-in-law. If he was that, he realized he didn't know if Jason Clary had plans to get married.
"Yes," Mark said.
He was standing upright as if facing a firing squad. He met Robert Lightwood's eyes, and Julian saw the Inquisitor flinch at the sight of Wild Hunt eyes and a shadow hunter's face. They were an accusation against the Clave, those eyes. They said, "You abandoned me. You did not protect me. I was alone."
"I have come back," Mark said.
"The Wild Hunt would never have released you," said the Inquisitor. "You were far too valuable to them, and fairies don't give back what they take."
"Robert," Magnus began.
"Tell me I'm wrong," Robert Lightwood said.
"Magnus?
Anyone?"
Magnus was silent, his unhappiness evident. Jace's gold eyes were unreadable. Drew made a frightened, stifled sound. Clary whirled on Robert.
"It's not fair to interrogate them," she said. "They're just kids."
"Don't you think I remember the trouble you and Jace got into when you were just kids?"
"He has a point." Jace smiled at Julian and Emma, and the smile was like gold melted over steel. You could see how the softness was a disguise, and how what lay under it had won Jace the title of best shadow hunter of his generation.
"We didn't use necromancy," said Julian. "We didn't need to. The thing about fairies, they're always willing to make a deal."
Two figures appeared in the doorway of the sanctuary. Ansel Nightshade, his sharp, bony face wary,
and beside him, Arthur, looking tired and carrying a glass of wine. Julian had left the full bottle in the sanctuary earlier that night. It was a good vintage. The protected space of the sanctuary extended slightly past the doors. Anselm edged a toe over the line, winced, and quickly pulled it back.
"Arthur, you claimed you were discussing Sophocles with Anselm Nightshade all evening," Robert Lightwood said.
"If you try to cure evil with evil, you will add more pain to your fate," said Arthur.
Robert raised an eyebrow.
"He's quoting Antigone," said Julian wearily.
"He means yes."
"Come into the room, Arthur," said Robert.
"Please do not give me the impression you're hiding in the sanctuary."
"When you use that voice, I want to hide in the sanctuary," said Magnus. He had begun wandering around the room, picking up objects and setting them down. His actions appeared idle, but Julian knew better. Magnus did little without premeditation. Neither did Jace. Jace was sitting on the lowest step of the stairs, his sharp gaze unwavering. Julian felt the weight of it, like pressure against his chest. He cleared his throat.
"My younger brothers and sisters have nothing to do with this," he said. "And Tavi's exhausted. He was almost killed tonight."
"What?" Clary said, alarm darkening her green eyes. "How did that happen?"
"I'll explain," Julian said. "Just let them go."
Robert hesitated for a moment before nodding curtly. "They can leave." Relief washed through Julian as Ty, Livy, and Drew headed up the steps, Livy still carrying Octavian against her shoulder. At the top, Ty paused for a moment and looked down. He was looking at Mark, and the expression on his face was fearful.
"It is the disease of tyranny to trust no friends, Inquisitor," said Anselm Nightshade.
"Aeschylus."
"I did not come here from my daughter's engagement party for a classics lesson," said Robert. "Nor is this downworlder business. Please wait for us in the sanctuary, Anselm."
Arthur passed his glass to Anselm, who raised it ironically but went, seeming relieved to get away from the demarcation line where hallowed ground began. The moment he was gone, Robert rounded on Arthur.
"What do you know about all this, Blackthorn?"
"A convoy came to us from Ferry," said Arthur. "They offered to return Mark to his family, and in exchange we would help them discover who was killing Ferries in Los Angeles."
"And you said nothing of this to the Clave?" said Robert.
"Despite knowing you were breaking the law, the cold peace."
"I wanted my nephew back," said Arthur.
"Wouldn't you have done the same for your family?"
"You're a shadow hunter," said Robert. "If you must choose between your family and the law, you choose the law."
"Lex mala, lex nulla," said Arthur. "You know our family motto."
"He did the right thing." For once there was no humor in Jace's voice.
"I would have done the same."
"Any of us would."
Robert looked exasperated.
"And did you discover it? Who was killing Ferries?"
"We discovered it tonight," said Julian.
"It was Malcolm Fade."
Magnus stiffened, his cat eyes flashing.
"Malcolm?"
He executed a quick about-face and marched toward Julian.
"And why do you think it was a warlock?"
"Because we know magic."
"Is all dark magic to be blamed on us, then?"
"Because he said he did it," said Julian.
Clary's mouth fell open. Jace remained seated, face unreadable as a cat's. Robert's expression darkened.
"Arthur, you're the head of the Institute. Talk. Or are you going to leave that to your nephew?"
"There are things," Julian said. "Things we didn't tell Arthur, things he doesn't know." Arthur put his hand to his head, as if it pained him.
"If I've been deceived," he said, "then let Julian explain it."
Robert's hard gaze swept over their group and fastened on Diego.
"Centurion," he said, "step forward."
Julian tensed.
"Diego."
He hadn't factored him in. But Diego was a centurion, and as such, sworn to tell the truth to the Clave. Of course Robert would want to talk to Diego instead of him. He knew there was no real reason for Robert to want to talk to him at all. He didn't run the Institute, Arthur did. Never mind that he'd been answering Robert's letters for years and recognized Robert's way of doing things better than anyone else here. Never mind that in official correspondence, at least, they knew each other well. He was just a teenage boy.
"Yes, Inquisitor," Diego said. "Speak to us of Malcolm Fade."
"Malcolm isn't who you think," Diego said. "He has been responsible for countless deaths. He was responsible for the deaths of Emma's parents." Robert shook his dark head. How was that possible? The Carstairs were murdered by Sebastian Morgenstern.
At the sound of Sebastian's name, Clary went pale. She looked immediately over at Jace, who matched her glance, a look woven through with years of shared history.
No, Clary said. They weren't. Sebastian was a murderer, but Emma has never believed that he was responsible for her parents' deaths, and neither have Jace or I.
She turned to look at Emma.
You were right, she said. I always thought you would be proved right someday. But I'm sorry it was Malcolm. He was your friend.
And mine, said Magnus, his voice strained. Clary moved toward him, placing her hand on his arm.
He was also the High Warlock, said Robert. How did this happen?
What do you mean he'd been murdering people?
A series of killings in Los Angeles, said Diego. He was convincing mundanes to commit murder, and then harvesting their bodies for parts he could use in necromancy.
The Clave should have been called in, Robert sounded furious. The Clave should have been called in the moment a ferry convoy approached you.
Inquisitor, said Diego. He sounded tired. The whole right shoulder of his gear was dark red with blood.
I am a centurion. I answered directly to the council. I didn't report what was happening either, because once things were in motion, reporting would have meant slowing things down.
He didn't look at Christina.
The Clave would have begun the investigation over again. There was no time, and the life of a child hung in the balance.
He put his hand to his chest.
If you wish to strip me of my medallion, I would understand. But I will maintain to the end that the Blackthorns did what was right.
I am not going to strip you of your medallion, Diego Rocio Rosales, said Robert. We have few centurions, and you are one of the best.
He looked at Diego critically, at his bloody arm and exhausted face.
The council will expect a report from you tomorrow, but for now, see to your wounds.
I'll go with him, Christina said. She helped Diego up the stairs, him leaning on her slender frame. Mark looked up at them, and then away as they disappeared past the witchlight into the shadows.
Robert, said Jace when they were gone.
When Julian was 12, he testified in front of the council.
It's been 5 years.
Let him talk now.
Despite the look of clear reluctance on his face, Robert nodded.
Very well, he said. Everyone wants to hear you speak, Julian Blackthorne. So speak.
Julian spoke. Calmly and without flourishes, he began to describe the investigation, from the first bodies found to their realization that evening of Malcolm's guilt.
Emma watched her pair of Batai as he spoke, and wondered how things would have turned out differently if Sebastian Morgenstern hadn't attacked the L.A. Institute 5 years ago. In Emma's mind, for years now, there had been two Julians. Julian before the attack, who was like everyone else, loving his family but annoyed by them too, a brother among brothers and sisters, with whom he squabbled and argued and teased and laughed. And Julian after. Julian, still a child, teaching himself how to feed and change a baby, cooking 4 different meals for 4 younger siblings who liked and disliked different things. Julian hiding his uncle's sickness from a mass of adults who would have taken his children away from him. Julian waking up from screaming nightmares that something had happened to Ty or Livy or Drew. Emma had been there to hold him, but she had never quite understood. How could she have, when she didn't know about Arthur, didn't know how alone Julian truly was? She only knew that the nightmares had faded and a quiet strength had settled over Jules, a hard determination before which the softness of childhood gave way. He hadn't been a boy in a long, long time. It had been that boy that Emma had thought could be her parabatai. She would never have fallen in love with that Julian, but she had fallen in love with this one, without knowing it, because how could you fall in love with someone you only half guessed existed? She wondered if Mark recognized the same dissonance in some way, if he saw the strangeness in how Julian stood and spoke to the Inquisitor now, as if they were 2 adults together. If he saw the care with which Julian told the story of what had happened, the key details he left out, the way he made it seem natural, inevitable, that they hadn't told the Clave what they were doing. The way he left out Kit and Johnny Rook. He wove a tale of a series of events that was nobody's fault, that no one could have foreseen or prevented, and he did it without a shred of guile ever showing on his face. When he was done, Emma shivered inside. She loved Julian. She would always love Julian. But for just that moment, she was a little afraid of him, too.
Malcolm was creating murderers? Robert echoed when Julian had stopped speaking.
It makes sense, said Magnus.
He stood with his chin cupped in his hand, one long finger tapping against his cheekbone.
One of the reasons necromancy is forbidden is that so many necessary ingredients are things like the hand of a murderer who killed in cold blood, or the eye of a hanged man which still holds the image of the last thing he saw. Obtaining those ingredients by orchestrating the situations that create them was ingenious.
He seemed to notice Robert glaring at him.
Very evil also, he added. Very. Your nephew tells a convincing story, Arthur, said Robert. But you are notably absent from it.
How did you not notice all of this was going on?
Julian had woven his story to make Arthur's absence seem natural, but Robert was like a dog with a bone.
Emma supposed that was why he had been elected to the position of Inquisitor.
Emma looked across the room and met Clary's green gaze with her own. She thought of Clary kneeling in front of her and Idris, holding her hands, complimenting Cortana. She thought of how the kindnesses that were shown to children were things they never forgot.
Robert, Clary said, there's no need for this. They made difficult decisions, but they weren't wrong decisions.
Then let me ask Arthur this, Clary, said Robert. What punishment would he choose for Nephilim, even young Nephilim, who break the law?
Well, that would depend, Arthur said, on whether they were punished already 5 years ago by losing their father and brother and sister.
Robert flushed darkly. It was the Dark War that took their family.
It was a clave that took Mark and Helen, said Magnus.
We expect betrayal from our enemies, not from those who are supposed to care for us.
We would have protected Mark, said Robert Lightwood. There was no need to fear the clave.
Arthur was pale, his eyes dilated. Yet Emma had never heard him speak so eloquently, or with such clarity. It was bizarre.
Would you have? He demanded. In that case, why is Helen still at Wrangell Island?
She's safer there, snapped Robert. There are those, not myself, who still hate the fairies for the betrayal of the Dark War. How do you think they would treat her if she were among other shadow hunters?
So you couldn't have protected Mark, said Arthur. You admit it.
Before Robert could speak, Julian said, Uncle Arthur, you can tell him the truth. Arthur looked puzzled. As clear-headed as he had seemed, he didn't seem to know what Julian meant. He was breathing quickly, too, as he had in the sanctuary when his head pained him. Julian turned to Robert.
Arthur wanted to go to the council as soon as the fair folk brought Mark here, he said. We begged him not to. We were afraid our brother would be taken away.
We thought if we could just solve the murders, if Mark helped us do it, it might make him look better in the eyes of the council, help convince them to let him stay.
But do you understand what you did? The Inquisitor demanded. Malcolm, if he was in pursuit of dark power, he could have posed a threat to all the clave.
Robert didn't sound convinced, though.
He wasn't in pursuit of power, said Julian. He wanted to raise someone he loved from the dead. It was evil what he did, and he's died for it, as he should have.
But it was his only goal and only plan. He never cared about the clave or shadow hunters, he only cared about her.
Poor Malcolm, said Magnus quietly. To lose the person he loved that way. We all knew that he had loved a girl who had become an Iron Sister. We had no idea of the truth.
Robert, Jay said, these kids haven't done anything wrong.
Perhaps not, but I'm the Inquisitor. I can hardly conceal this. With Malcolm Fade dead, having taken the Black Volume to the bottom of the ocean with him, and with all of this having happened without the head of the Institute having noticed, Julian stepped forward.
There's something Uncle Arthur isn't telling you, he said. He wasn't just letting us run around wild while he did nothing. He's been tracking down a different source of dark magic.
Julian looked at Magnus as he spoke. Magnus, who had helped them in the past. He seemed to be willing Magnus to understand and believe him.
It's no coincidence that Anselm Nightshade is in the sanctuary, Julian went on in a hard voice. Arthur brought him because he knew you were coming.
Robert raised an eyebrow.
Is that true, Arthur?
You'd better tell them, Julian said, looking hard at his uncle. They're going to find out anyway. Arthur was staring at Julian. There was a blankness on his face that made Emma's stomach knot up. Julian appeared to be almost willing Arthur to follow his lead.
I didn't want to mention it,
Arthur said, because it seemed to pale in comparison to what we learned about Malcolm.
Mention what?
Nightshade's been using dark magic for profit, said Julian. He kept his expression calm, a touch regretful. He's been making money hand over fist using addictive powders in the pizza he makes.
That's totally right, said Emma, speaking over Arthur's stunned silence. There are people all over the city so addicted that they would do anything for him just to get more.
Pizza thralls, said Jace. This is without doubt the weirdest.
He broke off as Clary stomped on his foot.
Seems serious, he said. I mean, addictive demon powders and all.
Julian crossed the room to the hall closet and yanked it open. Several pizza boxes slid out. Magnus, Julian said.
Magnus threw the end of his scarf over his shoulder and approached Julian and the boxes. He lifted the lid of a pizza box with as much gravity as if he were opening a locked treasure chest. He held his hand out over the box, turning it from left to right. Then he looked up. Arthur's right, he said. Dark magic. A cry echoed from inside the sanctuary.
Betrayal!
Anselm shouted.
Et tu, Brute!
He can't get out, said Arthur, looking dazed. The outside doors are locked. Robert took off running into the sanctuary. After a moment, Jason and Clary followed, leaving only Magnus, hands in his pockets, remaining in the foyer. Magnus regarded Julian with serious green-gold eyes.
Nicely done, he said.
I don't know quite how else to describe it, but nicely done. Julian looked over at Arthur, who was leaning back against the wall by the sanctuary door, his eyes half shut, pain etched on his face. I'll burn in hell for this, he muttered in a low voice. There is no shame in burning for your family, said Mark. I will burn beside you gladly. Julian looked at him, surprise and gratitude written across his face. And so will I, said Emma. She looked at Magnus. I'm sorry, she said. I'm the one who killed Malcolm. I know he was your friend, and I wish... He was my friend, said Magnus, his eyes darkening. I knew he had loved someone who died.
I didn't know the rest of the story. But Clave betrayed him, just like they betrayed you. I've lived a long time. I've seen many betrayals and many broken hearts. There are those who let their grief devour them, who forget that others also feel pain. If Alec died... He looked down at his hands.
I have to think I wouldn't be like that.
I'm just glad I finally know what happened to my parents, Emma said. Finally, I know.
Before anyone could add anything, there was an explosion of noise at the entrance to the sanctuary. Jace appeared suddenly, skidding backward, his fancy blazer ripped and his blonde hair mussed. He turned a smile on the rest of them, so bright it seemed to light up the room.
Clary has got Nightshade pinned in a corner, he said. He's pretty nimble for such an old vampire. Thanks for the exercise, by the way. And to think I thought tonight was going to be boring.
After everything had been sorted out with the Inquisitor, who had hauled off Ansel Nightshade, still vowing revenge, and most of the Institute's inhabitants had crawled off to bed, Mark went to the front door and looked out. It was nearly dawn. Mark could see the sunrise, far in the distance, at the eastern edge of the beach's curve. A pearlescent lightening of the water, as if white paint were spilling into the world through a crack in the sky.
Mark, said a voice at his shoulder. He turned. It was Jace Herondale. It was strange looking at Jace and Clary, strange in a way he doubted it was for his siblings. After all, the last time he'd seen them, they'd been Julian's age. They'd been the last shadow hunters he'd seen before he disappeared into the hunt. They were far from unrecognizable. They were probably only 21 or 22. But up close, Mark could see that Jace had acquired an indefinable aura of decisiveness and adulthood. Gone was the boy who had looked into Mark's eyes and said in a shaking voice, "The Wild Hunt. You're one of them now."
"Mark Blackthorn," Jace said. "I'd be polite and say you've changed, but you haven't."
"I have," Mark said, "just not in a way you can see."
Jay seemed to take this with good grace. He nodded and looked out toward the ocean.
A scientist said once that if the ocean were as clear as the sky, if we could see everything in it, no one would ever go into the sea. It's that horrifying, what lives in the water 5 miles down.
There speaks one who does not know the terrors of the sky, said Mark.
Maybe not, Jay said.
Do you still have the witch light I gave you?
Mark nodded.
I kept it with me through Fairy.
I've only ever given witch light runestones to two people in my life, said Jace. Clary, and you.
He cocked his head to the side.
There was something about you when we found you in the tunnels. You were frightened, but you weren't going to give up. I never had the slightest doubt I'd see you again.
Really? Mark looked at him, skeptically.
Really? Jay smiled his easy, charming smile. Just remember that the New York Institute is on your side, he said. Remind Julian if you're ever in trouble again. It's not simple running an institute. I ought to know.
Mark began to protest, but Jace had already turned and gone back inside to rejoin Clary. Mark somehow doubted Jace would have paid any attention to his protest if he'd made it. He'd clearly seen the situation for what it was, but wasn't planning on doing anything to upset the balance.
Mark scanned the horizon again. Dawn was spreading. The road and the highway, the desert trees, all were thrown into sharp relief by the increasing light. And there by the edge of the road stood Kieran, looking out toward the sea. Mark could see him only as a shadow, but even as a shadow, Kieran could never have been anyone else. He went down the steps and over to where Kieran was standing. He had not changed his clothes, and the blade of his sword, which hung by his side, was stained with gore.
Kieran, Mark said.
You will stay?
Kieran asked, and then caught himself with a rueful look.
Of course you will stay.
If you're asking if I'm going to remain with my family or go back to the wild hunt, then yes, you have your answer, said Mark. The investigation is over. The murderer and his followers are gone.
That was not the letter of the bargain, said Kieran. The Shadow Hunters were to release the murderer into the custody of Fairy, for us to mete out justice.
Given that Malcolm is dead, and the magnitude of Aerloth's betrayal, I expect your folk to look with leniency upon my choice, said Mark.
My folk, Kieran echoed. You know they are not lenient. They have not been lenient with me.
Mark thought of the first time he had seen Kieran's black eyes staring out defiantly from the tangle of his dark hair. He thought of the glee of the other hunters at having a prince to torment and mock. How Kieran had borne it, with an arrogant curl to his lip and a lift of his chin. How he had borne the fact that his father had thrown him to the hunt, the way a man might throw a bone to a dog. Kieran had not had a brother who loved him and fought to get him back. He had not had Julian.
But I will fight for you, he said, meeting Mark's gaze. I will tell them it is your right to stay.
He hesitated.
Will we see each other again?
I don't think so, Kieran, said Mark, as gently as he could. Not after all that has happened. A brief ripple of pain, quickly hidden, passed across Kieran's face. The color of his hair had faded to a silvery blue, not unlike the shade of the ocean in the morning.
I did not expect a different answer, he said. I hoped, though. It is hard to kill hope, but I suppose I lost you a long time ago.
Not that long, said Mark. You lost me when you came here with Gwen and Aerloth, and you let them whip my brother. I could forgive you for any pain incurred by me, but I will never forgive you for what Julian and Emma suffered.
Emma, said Kieran, his brows drawing together. I thought it was the other girl who had drawn your fancy. Your princess.
Mark gave a choked laugh.
By the angel, he said, and saw Kieran blanch at the Shadow Hunter words. Your imagination is limited by your jealousy.
Kieran, everyone who lives under this roof, whether they are bound by blood or not, we are tied together by an invisible net of love and duty and loyalty and honor. That is what it means to be a Shadow Hunter. Family.
What would I know of family? My father sold me to the wild hunt. I do not know my mother. I have 36 brothers, all of whom would gladly see me dead.
Mark,
you are all I have.
Kieran.
And I love you,
Kieran said.
You are all that exists on the earth and under the sky that I do love.
Mark looked into Kieran's eyes, the silver and the black, and he saw in them, as he always had, the night sky.
and he felt that treacherous pull under his ribcage, the one that said that the clouds could be his road, that he need never worry about human concerns, money and shelter and rules and laws. He could ride through the skies over glaciers, through the treetops of forests no human being knew existed. He could sleep in the ruins of cities lost for centuries. His shelter could be a single blanket. He could lie in Kieran's arms and count the stars. But he had always given the stars his brothers and sisters' names. There was beauty in the idea of freedom, but it was an illusion. Every human heart was chained by love. Mark drew his elf bolt necklace up over his head. He reached out and took Kieran's hand, turning it over so it was palm up, and dropped the necklace into it. "I will draw no more bows for the wild hunt," he said. "Keep this and perhaps remember me." Kieran's hand tightened on the arrowhead, his knuckles whitening. "The stars will go out before I forget you, Mark Blackthorne." Lightly, Mark touched Kieran's cheek. The fairy prince's eyes were wide and tearless, but in them Mark could see a great wilderness of loneliness, a thousand dark nights spent riding with no home to arrive at. "I do not forgive you," he said, "but you came to help us at the end. I do not know what would have happened if you hadn't. So if you need me, if it is a true need, send for me and I will come." Kieran half closed his eyes. "Mark." But Mark had already turned away. Kieran stood and watched him go, and though he did not move or speak, at the edge of the bluff, Windspear reared up and cried out, his hooves pawing at the sky. Julian's window looked out over the desert. At any point during the past 5 years, he would have switched out from Mark's room, which had a view of the ocean. But it would have felt like giving up on the idea that Mark would ever come back. And besides, his was the only room with a window seat, lined with now slightly threadbare cushions. He and Emma had spent hours there together, reading and drawing, the sun through the glass turning her pale hair to fire. He was sitting there now, the window cranked open to carry away the scents that still seemed to hang over him, even after a shower. Blood and wet stone, seawater and dark magic. Everything ended eventually, he thought. Even the strangest night of his life. Clary had taken him and Emma aside after Anselm had been captured, hugged them, reminded them that they could always call. He knew Clary was, in her quiet way, trying to tell him, tell both of them, that it was all right to lay their burdens on her. He knew he never would. His phone trilled. He glanced down at the screen. It was Emma. She'd sent him a photo. No words, just the picture of her closet. The door open, the photographs and maps and string and notes spilling out. He threw on jeans and a t-shirt and headed down the hall. The Institute was dead silent, wrapped in sleep. The only sound, the desert wind outside, soughing against glass and stone. Emma was in her room, sitting up against the footboard of her bed, her phone on the floor beside her. She was wearing a nightgown, long with thin straps, pale white in the fading moonlight. "Julian," she said, knowing he was there without looking up. "You were awake, right? I had a feeling you were awake." She stood up, still looking at her closet. "I don't know what to do with it," she said. "I spent such a long time collecting everything that seemed like evidence, making guesses, thinking about this and nothing but this. This was my big secret, the heart of everything I did." She looked toward him. "Now it's just a closet full of junk." "I can't tell you what you should do with all of that," he said. "But I can't tell you. You don't need to think about it now." Her hair was down, like spun light around her shoulders, tickling her face with the ends of curls, and he dug his fingers into his palms to keep himself from pulling her against him so he could bury his face and hands in it. He looked instead at the healing cuts on her arms and hands, the fading red of her burned wrist, the evidence that tonight had not been easy. Nothing they did ever was. "Mark's saying," she said, "right? There's nothing the Clave can do to take him away now." "Mark. Her first thought is about Mark." Julian pushed the thought down, away. It was unworthy, ridiculous. They weren't 12 anymore. "Nothing," Julian said. "He was never exiled. The rule was only that we couldn't look for him. We didn't. He found his way home, and they can't change that. And I think after the help he gave us with Malcolm,
It would be a very unpopular move if they tried.
She flashed a faint smile at him before clambering up onto the bed, sliding her long bare legs under the coverlet.
I went to check on Diego and Christina, she said. He was passed out in her bed and she was asleep in the chair next to him. I'm going to make so much fun of her tomorrow.
Is Christina in love with him?
Diego, I mean, Julian asked, sitting down on the side of Emma's bed.
Not sure, Emma wiggled her fingers.
They have, you know, stuff.
No, I don't know. He copied her gesture. What's that?
Unfinished romantic business, Emma said, pulling the blanket up.
Finger wiggling means unfinished business? I'll have to keep that in mind.
Julian felt a smile tug the corners of his mouth. Only Emma could make him smile after a night like the one they'd had.
She turned back a corner of the blanket.
Stay?
There was nothing he wanted more than to crawl in beside her, to trace the shape of her face with his fingers. Wide cheekbones, pointed chin, half-lidded eyes, eyelashes like lace against his fingertips. His body and mind were beyond exhausted, too worn out for desire. But the yearning for closeness and companionship remained. The touch of her hands, her skin, was a comfort nothing else could reproduce. He remembered the beach, lying awake for hours trying to memorize what it was like to hold Emma. They'd slept beside each other so many times, but he'd never realized how different it was when you could encompass the shape of someone else in your arms. Fit your breathing to their breathing. He crawled into bed beside her, clothes still on, and slid under the covers. She was on her side, her head propped on her hand. Her expression was serious, intent.
The way you orchestrated everything tonight, Julian, you scared me a little.
He touched the edge of her hair briefly before dropping his hand. A slow ache was spreading through his body, a deep ache that seemed to come from the marrow of his bones. You should never be scared of me, he said. Never. You're one of the people I would never hurt. She reached out a hand and put her palm against his heart. The fabric of his t-shirt separated her hand and his chest, but he felt the touch as if it were on his bare skin.
Tell me what happened when we got back, with Arthur and Anselm, she said, because I don't think I even understand it.
So he told her. Told her about how for months he'd been emptying the dregs of the vials Malcolm gave him for Arthur into a bottle of wine just in case. How he'd left the wine containing this super dosage in the sanctuary. How he'd realized at the convergence that they would need Arthur to be clear-headed when they returned, to be functioning. The way he'd called Arthur, telling him he needed to offer the wine to Anselm and drink some himself, knowing it would affect only his uncle. How he knew he'd done a terrible thing, dosing his uncle without his knowledge. How he'd planted the pizza boxes in the foyer the first time they'd ordered it, just in case. How he knew he'd done a terrible thing to Anselm, who did not deserve the punishment he was likely to get. How he didn't know who he was sometimes, how he was capable of doing the things he did, and yet, how he couldn't not do them. When he was done, she leaned in, touching his cheek gently. She smelled faintly of rose water soap. I know who you are, she said. You're my Parabatai. You're the boy who does what has to be done because no one else will. Parabatai. He had never thought of the word with bitterness before, even feeling what he felt and knowing what he knew. And yet now, he thought of the years and years ahead of them in which there would be no time in which they felt fully safe together. No way to touch or kiss or reassure each other without fear of discovery. And a sudden emotion surged through him, uncontrollable. What if we ran away, he said.
Ran away, she echoed, and went where?
Somewhere they wouldn't find us. I could do it. I could find a place. He saw the sympathy in her eyes. They'd figure out why. We wouldn't be able to come back.
They forgave us for breaking the cold peace, he said.
And he knew he sounded desperate. He knew his words were tripping over themselves. But they were words he had wanted to say, not dared to say, for years. They were words that belonged to a part of himself that had been locked up so long he had wondered if it were even still living. They need shadow hunters. There aren't enough of us. They might forgive us for this, too.
Julian, you wouldn't be able to live with yourself if you left the kids.
And Mark, and Helen. I mean, you just got Mark back. There's no way. He held back thought of them, of his brothers and sisters, as if he were Poseidon holding back the tide. Are you saying this because you don't want to go away with me? Because if you don't want it...
In the distance down the hall, a thin cry rose. Tavi. Julian was out of bed in seconds, the floor cold against his bare feet. I better go. Emma pushed herself up on her elbows. Her face was serious, dominated by her wide, dark eyes. I'll go with you. They hurried down the hall to Tavi's room. The door was propped open, a dim witchlight burning inside. Tavi was curled up, half in and half out of his tent, tossing and turning in his sleep. Emma was on her knees next to him in moments, stroking his disarrayed brown hair.
Baby, she murmured. Poor baby, by the angel, what a night for you.
She lay down on her side, facing Tavi, and Julian lay down on the little boy's other side. Tavi gave a cry and curled back into Julian, his breath softening as he relaxed into sleep. Julian looked across his little brother's curly head at Emma.
Do you remember?
He said. He could see in her eyes that she did remember. The years they'd taken care of the others. The nights they stayed up with Tavi or with Drew, with Ty and Livy. He wondered if she'd spun fantasies as he had, that they were married and these their children.
I remember, she said. That's why I said you couldn't ever leave them. You couldn't stand it.
She propped her head on her hand, the scar on her forearm, a white line in the dimness.
I don't want you to do something you'll spend your life regretting.
I've already done something I'm going to spend my life regretting, he said, thinking of the circles of fire in the silent city, the rune on his collarbone. Now I'm trying to fix it. She lowered her head gently to the floor beside Tavi, her pale hair making a pillow.
Like you said about my closet, she said. Let's talk about it tomorrow, okay?
He nodded, watching as she closed her eyes, as her breaths evened out into sleep. He'd waited this long, after all. He could wait another day. After the dawn, Emma woke from a nightmare, crying the names of her parents, and of Malcolm, aloud. Julian picked her up in his arms and carried her down the hallway to her own bedroom.
27. Sever My Soul. The last time Kit Rook ever saw his father, it was an ordinary day and they were sitting in their living room. Kit was sprawled on the floor reading a book on cons and scams. According to Johnny Rook, it was time to learn the classics, which for most people would have meant Hemingway and Shakespeare, but for Kit meant memorizing things like The Spanish Prisoner and The Melon Drop. Johnny was in his favorite chair, in his usual thinking pose, fingers templed under his chin, legs crossed. It was times like this, when the sun slanted through the window and lit up the fine, sharp bones of his father's face, that Kit wondered about all the things he didn't know. Who his mother had been, if it was true, as was whispered in the market, that Johnny's family was English aristocracy who tossed him out when he manifested his sight. It wasn't that Kit yearned to be aristocracy, so much as he wondered what it would be like to be in a family that had more than two people in it. The ground suddenly seized up under him. Kit's book went flying, and he slid several feet across the floor before slamming into the coffee table. He sat up, heart speeding, and saw his father already at the window. Kit got to his feet.
Earthquake?
He said. When you lived in Southern California, you got used to small shiftings of the fault lines in the earth, waking up in the night with glasses rattling in the kitchen cupboards. Johnny turned away from the window, his face deathly pale.
Something's happened to the Guardian, Johnny said. The protection spells on the house have faded.
What? Kit was bewildered. Their house had been warded for as long as he could remember.
His father had always spoken of the wards as if they were the roof or the foundation.
Essential. Necessary. Built into the fabric of their home. He remembered then, last year, his father saying something about demon protection spells. More powerful ones. Johnny swore, a fluent string of curses, and whirled toward the bookcase. He seized a worn spell book.
Get downstairs, Kit,
he said, moving to kick aside the rug in the middle of the room, revealing the protection circle there.
But... I said, get downstairs.
Johnny took a step toward his son, as if he meant to reach out to him, to touch his shoulder, perhaps. Then he dropped his arm.
Stay in the cellar and don't come out, no matter what happens, he barked and turned back to the circle.
Kit began to back toward the stairs. He stumbled down one step and then another before pausing. Johnny's phone was on a low shelf of the bookcase, reachable from the steps. Kit grabbed it up, looking for the name, her name. But if you change your mind, you have my number in your phone, under Carstairs.
He barely had time to type out a message when the floor of the living room exploded upward. Things spilled up from the space below. They looked like massive praying mantises, their bodies the bitter green of poison. They had small triangular heads with wide mouths filled with jagged teeth, long bodies that gleamed with slime, and jagged, razored forelegs. Kit's father stood frozen in the middle of his circle. A demon flung itself toward him and bounced off the spell that surrounded him. Another followed, equally unsuccessful. The demon set up a loud chittering. Kit couldn't move. He knew about demons, of course. He'd seen pictures, even smelled the scent of demonic magic. But this was different. He caught his father's eye. Johnny was glaring at him in a mixture of panic and fury. Get downstairs! Kit tried to make his feet move, to carry him. They wouldn't. Panic made him freeze. The largest demon seemed to catch the scent of him and buzzed in excitement. It began to scuttle toward him. Kit looked at his father, but Johnny didn't move. He stayed in his circle, his eyes bulging. The demon lunged for Kit, razored forelegs extended. And Kit jumped. He had no idea how he did it, or how his body knew what to do. He pushed off from the stairs and hurtled over the banister, landing in a crouch in the living room. The demon, which had been reaching for him, gave a loud screech as it lost its balance and toppled downstairs, smashing into the wall of the landing. Kit whirled back around. For a moment, he caught his father's eye. There was something in Johnny's expression that was almost sorrowful, a look Kit had never seen before. And then another chunk of the floor collapsed, taking a section of the protection circle with it. Kit flung himself backward. He flipped into the air and came down balanced on the arms of a chair, just in time to see two of the demons seize his father and rip him in half. Emma was in the middle of a very confusing dream about Magnus Bane and a troop of clowns when she was awoken by a hand on her shoulder. She muttered and dug herself deeper into the bedclothes, but the hand was insistent. It stroked down her arm, which was actually very pleasant. A warm mouth brushed the edge of her lips. "Emma," Julian said. Vague memories of him carrying her down the hall to her bedroom and then collapsing beside her drifted through the tired fog in her brain. She thought. There really seemed to be no reason to get up at all, not when Julian was being affectionate. She feigned sleep as he kissed her cheek, and then along her jaw, and then... She sat bolt upright, sputtering. "You stuck your tongue in my ear!" "Yep," he grinned. "It did get you moving, didn't it?" "Ugh!" She threw an I Love Callie pillow at him, which he nimbly ducked. He was wearing jeans and a gray t-shirt that made his eyes look lapis blue. He was clearly just awake and tousle-haired and so adorable that she could only keep herself from attacking him by putting her hands behind her back. "Why are you putting your hands behind your back?" he asked. "No reason." She wrinkled up her nose. "That ear thing was weird. Don't do it again." "How about this?" he suggested and leaned in to kiss the base of her throat. Sensation spiraled out from the places his lips touched, her collarbone first, then her neck, then the side of her mouth. She drew her hands out from behind her back and reached for him. His skin was sunshine warm. Their faces were so close that she could see the small starbursts of color inside his eyes. Pale gold, paler blue. He wasn't smiling. His expression was too intent for that. There was a wanting in his eyes that made her feel like she was breaking apart. Their legs tangled in the blankets as they came together, mouths seeking. He still wasn't an expert kisser, but she liked that. She liked being reminded that he hadn't been with anyone but her, that she was his first. She liked that something as simple as a kiss was still a source of amazement for him. She used her tongue to trace the corners of his mouth, the seam of his lips, until he sank back on the bed, pulling her on top of him. His body shuddered, arching up toward hers, his hands sliding down to grip her hips. "Emma?" There was a knock on the door. They jerked away from each other, Julian rolling off the bed, Emma sitting upright, her heart pounding. "Emma, it's Drew. Have you seen Jules?" "No," Emma croaked. "I haven't." The door started to open. "Don't," Emma called. I'm getting dressed." "Whatever," Drew said dismissively, but the door didn't open further. Resolutely, Emma didn't look toward Julian. "Everything's fine," she told herself. "Calm. Be calm." "Well, if you see him, can you tell him Tavi and everyone need lunch? Livy and Ty are making a mess in the kitchen, too." Her voice held the satisfied tone of a sibling tattling on another sibling. "Sure," said Emma. "Did you check the studio? He might be there." There was a rustle.
No, I didn't. Good idea. See you later.
Bye,
Emma said faintly. Drew's footsteps were already receding down the hall. Finally, Emma let herself look at Julian. He was leaning against the wall, his chest rising and falling fast, his eyes half-lidded, teeth digging into his lip. He exhaled.
Raziel, he whispered. That was close.
Emma got to her feet, her nightgown swishing around her knees. She was shaking.
We can't, she started.
We can't. We'll get caught.
Julian was already across the room, taking her in his arms. She could feel his heart slamming against his ribcage, but his voice was steady. It's a stupid law, he said. It's a bad law, Em.
There's a reason you can't fall in love with your Parabatai, Emma. And when you find out what it is, you will feel the cruelty of the Shadow Hunters just as I have.
Malcolm's voice, unwelcome and unavoidable, pushed its way into Emma's brain. She'd done all she could to forget it, forget what he'd said. He'd been lying. He'd lied about everything else. This had to be a lie, too. And yet, she'd put it off, but she knew she had to tell Julian. He had the right to know.
We have to talk, she said.
She felt his heart skip.
Don't say that. I know it's not good.
He pulled her tighter against him. Don't get scared, Emma, he whispered.
Don't let us go because you're frightened.
I am frightened. Not for me, for you. Everything you've done, all the hiding and pretending, to keep the kids together. The situation hasn't changed, Julian. If I hurt any of you...
He kissed her, stemming the tide of words. Despite everything, she felt the kiss all through her body.
I used to read law books, he said, drawing away from her. The parts about Parabatai, I read them a million times. There's never been a case of a pair of Parabatai who fell in love and got caught and were forgiven. Only horror stories. And I can't lose my family.
You were right. It would kill me. But the horror stories are about the ones who got caught. He breathed in deep, holding her gaze. If we're careful, we won't be.
She wondered if Julian had pushed himself past some point the night before. A point where the responsibilities that bowed him under seemed insurmountable. It was absolutely unlike Julian to want to break the rules, and though she wanted what he wanted, it unnerved her nonetheless.
We'd have to set rules, he said, strict ones. When we could see each other, we'd have to be careful, much more careful than we have been. No more beach, no more studio. We have to be absolutely sure, every time, that we were somewhere we wouldn't be walked in on.
She nodded.
In fact, no talking about it either, she said. Not in the Institute, not where someone might hear us.
Julian nodded. His pupils were slightly dilated, his eyes the color of an oncoming storm over the ocean.
You're right, he said. We can't talk here. I'll throw some lunch together for the kids, so they don't keep looking for me. Then meet me down on the beach, okay? You know where. Where I pulled you out of the water, where this all started.
Okay, she said, after a slight hesitation. You go first, and I'll meet you there.
But I still have something I need to tell you.
The important thing is that we stay together, Emma. That's what matters. She raised herself up on her tiptoes and kissed him, a long, slow, intoxicating kiss that made him groan low in his throat. When she drew away, he was staring at her. How do people handle these feelings? He seemed honestly bewildered. How are they not all over each other all the time if they're, you know, in love?
Emma swallowed against a sudden urge to cry. In love. He hadn't said it before. I love you, Julian Blackthorn, she thought, looking at him there in her room, as he had been a million times before, and yet it was completely different now. How could anything be so safe and familiar and yet so terrifying and all-encompassing and new at the same time? She could see the faint pencil scratch markings on the doorframe behind him where they had once recorded their heights each year. They'd stopped doing it when he'd gotten taller than her, and the highest of the marks now was far below Julian's head.
I'll see you on the beach, she whispered. He hesitated for a moment, then nodded and walked out of the room. There was a strange feeling of foreboding in her chest as she watched him go. How would he react to what Malcolm had told her? Even if he dismissed it as lies, how could you plan a life of hiding and sneaking around as if it were a happy thing? She'd never really understood the point of engagement parties and the like before, though she was happy for Isabel and Simon. But she got it now. When you were in love, you wanted to tell people about it,
and that was exactly what they couldn't do. At least she could reassure him, though, that she loved him, that she always would, that no one could take his place. Her thoughts were interrupted by a loud buzzing. Her phone. She padded over to the bureau to pick it up, using her thumb to open the home screen. A text message was displayed there, in bold red letters. Emergency. Please come now. Please. Kit Rook.
Christina?
Christina uncurled herself slowly. Her back and legs ached. She'd fallen asleep in the chair beside her bed. She could, she supposed, have curled up on the floor, but it would have been more difficult to keep an eye on Diego that way. The wound to his shoulder had been much worse than she'd thought, a deep cut surrounded by the red blister burn of dark magic that made healing runes nearly ineffective. She'd cut his bloody gear off him, and the shirt under it as well, soaked through with sweat and blood. She'd brought towels and padded the bed under him with them, wetted some of them down to sponge the blood from his face and neck. She'd given him pain-killing rune after pain-killing rune, healing rune after healing rune. Still, he tossed and turned much of the night, his storm-black hair tangled against the pillows. Not since she'd left Mexico had she so clearly and painfully remembered what they had been to each other when they were younger, how much she had loved him. Her heart had felt torn to pieces when he cried out for his brother, pleading with him, Jaime, Jaime, ayúdame. Help me. And then he had cried out for her, and that was worse. Cristina, no me dejes. Regresa. Cristina, don't leave me. Come back. I'm here, she told him. Estoy aquí. But he hadn't woken up, and his fingers had clawed at the sheets until he'd fallen into an uneasy slumber. She didn't remember how long after that she'd fallen asleep herself. She'd been able to hear the sound of voices from downstairs and then footsteps in the hall. Emma had ducked in to check on her and Diego, had hugged her, and gone to sleep when Christina had assured her that everything was all right. But there was light streaming through the window now, and Diego was looking at her, with eyes clear of pain and fever.
¿Estás bien?
She whispered, her throat dry. He sat up, and the sheet fell away from him. It was, Christina thought, rather a sudden reminder that he wasn't wearing a shirt. She focused on the fact that there was a mark on his chest where Malcolm's magic had struck him. It was over his heart, like a marriage rune would be, and it was a more intense violet than a bruise. It was almost the color of Malcolm's eyes.
Yes, I am, he said, sounding a little surprised. I am all right. Were you with...
He looked down, and for a moment, he was very much the little boy Christina remembered, trailing in Jaime's disastrous wake, weathering trouble and scoldings in quiet silence.
I dreamed you stayed with me.
I did stay with you. She resisted the urge to lean forward and push his hair back. And everything's all right? He asked. I don't remember much after we returned. She nodded.
It worked out surprisingly well.
This is your room? Diego said, glancing around. His gaze lit on something past her left ear, and he smiled.
I remember that.
Christina turned to look. Perched on a shelf by the bed was an árbol de vida, a tree of life. A delicate pottery framework hung all over with ceramic flowers, moons, suns, lions, mermaids, and arrows. The angel Gabriel rested at the bottom, his back against the tree, his shield across his knee. It was one of the few reminders of home she'd brought with her when she left.
You made it, she said. For my birthday. I was 13.
He leaned forward, hands on his knees. Do you miss home, Christina? He asked. Even a little bit?
Of course I miss it, she said.
The line of his back was smooth, unbroken. She remembered digging her nails into his shoulder blades when they kissed.
I miss my family.
I miss even the traffic in the DF. Not that it's much better here.
I miss the food. You wouldn't believe what they call Mexican food here.
I miss eating caletas in the park with you. She remembered lime and chili powder on her hands, a little bit sour and a little bit hot.
I miss you, he said. Every day I miss you. Diego.
She slid from the chair onto the bed and reached for his right hand. It was broad and warm in hers, and she felt the pressure of his family ring against her hand. Both of them wore the ring of the Rosales family, but hers had the pattern of the Mendozas on the inside, and his the Rocios.
You saved my life, she said. I regret that I was so unforgiving. I should have known better. Should have known you better.
Christina.
His free hand found her hair, her cheek. His fingertips brushed her skin lightly. He leaned toward her, giving her ample time to back away.